All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fucknicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. How's it going? I am enjoying the winter here in L.A. The winter takes the temperature down to the sometimes low 50s, maybe even high 40s, and we're all bundled up here. It is chilly, and I welcome it because I miss the Eastern Seaboard fall weather. I miss it. I'm just out here in the sun. Today's show is interesting. There is a theme. There may not seem to be one initially when I lay it out, but there is sort of a connecting tissue. Today we have Sam Pollard. He's a documentary film director, also a film editor, worked with Spike Lee for years, but he's got a documentary film called Two Trains Running. It's opening at the Metrograph in New York City tomorrow, December 2nd, and I hope that the interest in the film will get it a wider release so everyone listening to this can eventually see it. But the way I heard about it was kind of interesting. My neighbor, Adam Hawkey, is a colorist. I think he does something in post-production with film. And he hit me to this documentary. So I'm working on this thing. I think you'd be interested in this guy, Sam Pollard. It's about the civil rights movement, but it's also about blues music. And so I was like, really? And I did a little research, and then I tracked down Sam Pollard and had him out here to talk about this documentary. I got a cut of it, not a final cut, but I got to watch the film, and it was an interesting fusion of two very distinctly different but similar. How can I explain it? The movie Two Trains Running. I'll explain that in a minute, but I do want to give a little bit of lip service before we get into it to my next set of guests. It's a doubleheader. The Handsome Family are musicians. Now, you probably know their work if you watched True Detective. I believe it was the theme song, Far From Any Road. It was a Handsome Family song. Now, the Handsome Family are Brett and Rennie Sparks. They're a married couple, and they live in Albuquerque, where I grew up and occasionally go to hang out, see my dad, touch base with the roots of my life. Now, their music is very haunting. It's very sort of gothic folk music, very kind of fueled by the ancient folk themes and stylings, and it's beautiful. And I had several of their records that I listened to, and I was sort of fascinated with because the packaging of the records is beautiful, because Rennie does all the artwork, all the painting, all the putting together of the packaging of the covers, and it's a whole thing. The Handsome Family is the music and the artwork is a whole world, and it's a beautiful world. So when I was in Albuquerque, I got in touch with them. I invited them over to where I was staying, Brett and Rennie, and we talked. So that's the second part of today's WTF. But this, getting back to the blues music and getting back to Sam Pollard, I don't know when I first heard blues music, you know, the old style, but it is definitely part of my heart and mind, and it's deep down in there. And there were certain moments in my life with blues music that, you know, even as an older person, where you find new stuff. I remember the first time I listened to those Robert Johnson recordings, and I was like, I don't get it. You can barely hear it. And then it sort of grows with you. If you have the template in your heart for old traditional blues music, it kind of evolves as you get older, and it sort of becomes more enriched as you get older, and you find more in it, and you kind of go to a place with it. But not long ago in my life, I read a biography of Skip James. I'm going someplace with this, people, and I started getting into Skip James music, which is really one of the most sort of unique and haunting, again, I'm going to use that word, blues that you can find. He did the original "I'm So Glad," which I think Cream covered, and it just, his voice was something beyond almost human understanding, and the tone that he got with his songs was something completely unique in blues. Now this movie, Two Trains Running, tracks. It's very interesting. It's 1964, and it's the it tracks the sort of the migration of civil rights workers and college students, you know, down to Mississippi for the civil rights movement, for the Freedom Summer, it was called. And that's one trajectory of the film. And the other trajectory are these two sets of dudes who had no real concept of what was necessarily going on in Mississippi at the time, but coincidentally went down there from two different places, one from the Bay Area, that includes John Fahey, the guitar player, and the other one from the Boston area, which included Dick Waterman. And they were just coincidentally going down to find these old blues musicians, because at the time, there were these record freaks that had these old 78s of this old music that seemed to disappear. So in 1964, no one really knew, in the collective mind about Skip James or Son House, but these musicians and blues freaks did, and there was this constant sort of like curiosity as to whether they were still alive and whether they could find some of these guys. And Fahey and his crew, coincidentally, with the went down looking for Skip James, and Waterman and his crew, went looking for Son House from different parts of the country in the same basic area, and in the same basic area of the civil rights movement, of the Freedom Summer and the voting rights movement. You move through this search for these two blues musicians and the sort of fight for civil rights and voting rights, and it all culminates in, obviously, voting rights legislation and awareness of what was going on in the segregated South. But then it also moves towards, on the other trajectory, the Newport Folk Festival, where they brought all these musicians that had not been heard from in decades, down up from the South and wherever they were, Skip James included. And he performed for the first time. They found him in a hospital. And they gave him a guitar. It's sort of a beautiful story. And to see and hear Skip James at Newport that year was just mind-blowing. And obviously, all this stuff that happened in from the activism in the civil rights movement sort of all happened at the same time. But I'd never seen these two things put together. And that's what this film does. And it was, I loved it. And the deal is that this film in particular, look, if you want to see it, it's sort of hard to see it. And I like the movie, and I'd love to help find it a wider audience. So if you're a film distributor out there, you should definitely pick this. You should definitely pick this film up, because it's worth seeing. And it's a great sort of bringing together of two very important narratives in the cultural history. So right now, I'd like to let you listen to me and Sam Pollard, the director of Two Trains Running. So let's do that now. You've been an editor for how long?
I've been editing since 1975. So it's almost 41 years.
All the time in New York?
I spent some time here in L.A. cutting a couple of feature films, and some time in Boston and D.C., but primarily in New York City.
Really? Now, like, when you started, like, where'd you grow up? Where'd you come from?
I grew up in East Harlem.
Yeah.
In New York City.
Yeah.
In the 50s and the early 60s.
Really?
Yep.
So you've seen a lot of changes in your lifetime.
You'll be surprised, Mark, how much I've seen. Yeah. Sometimes it amazes me all the things I've seen in my lifetime.
Well, how old are you? You're a little older than me?
What are you? 66.
Oh, yeah. So you're alive and awake.
Yeah, I'm 66.
During, the 50s and 60s.
Yep, Dr. King, Malcolm X, Black Panthers.
Well, if you were 60, so you're born, so you're like a teenager.
I was a teenager.
When Malcolm and all that was happening. Down the street.
That's right. Up in Harlem.
And right. And, what are you, how, like 15, 14?
14, 15 years old.
And what, like... What events do you remember? The tone of, like, you know, what was happening?
You know what I remember? I remember 1964 when there were some riots in Harlem.
Yeah.
Being on the bus going uptown, ducking when people were saying they're throwing missiles at the bus.
And, oh, really?
You know, oh, yeah. That I remember. You know, I remember, you know, when Malcolm was killed, you know, and the tension I felt in the city, and when Dr. King was assassinated. All those things, you know, I remember growing up in Harlem. I mean, also, I grew up in a community where I grew up loving Latin music and jazz and soul and all these things. So it's a lot of things going on.
Well, in Harlem, yeah, always, right? Because there was a big mixture of ethnic forces, musically and otherwise.
Oh, yeah. You know, there was growing up listening to Tito Puente and Eddie Palmieri and Charlie Parker and
Jesse
Gillespie and Marvin Gaye and the Temptations, a lot of music.
Yeah, and was it a big family you come from?
Not my immediate family. I had two siblings, but my extended family, which goes all the way to Mississippi. My father's from Mississippi, and he was one of nine children.
Uh-huh.
And then his siblings had lots of children, so I have, like, you know, hundreds of cousins. hundreds of cousins.
So when you're a director of a documentary, how does the relationship with the story, how does it evolve? Because the story to me was beautiful balance. Like this sort of like naive, you know, compulsive, nerdy journey of these guitar nerds and blues nerds to go find these guys, you know, alongside of a very brutal of the, you know, of the Freedom, the Summer Project in 64, was a very interesting balance that lended a, you know, like it could have been very, you know, brutal, but it had a balance to it.
Well, you know, one of the things that I have to tip my hat off to Ben Hedin about is that it was his idea.
Yeah.
You know, he really came to me about 3.5 years ago with this idea. He wanted to do a documentary that looked at John Fahey and Dick Waterman and Nick Pearl's searching for Son House and Skip James. But at the same time, he wanted to tell the story of the young white kids who went down for Freedom Summer.
Right.
Now, initially, I thought, you know, as a film editor and a filmmaker, I said, Ben, that's a lot to chew off to try to make those two stories work.
Right,
you
know, right,
really
yeah.
Really intense, really difficult. But he was pretty tenacious about wanting to do it. So I finally got on board and I started to think, I think we can make it happen. One of the things that can help make this film come to life and to help that balance would be to find contemporary musicians to play the music of Son and Skip. So Lucinda Williams, Gary Clark Jr.
Yeah.
You know, and then find the people from both the aspect of understanding who Dick and Nick and Jeff and John Fahey was, and then finding people who were also down for the Freedom Summer.
Right.
So we can have these parallel stories. And the really important thing to remember that Ben made us aware of was that the day that Son and Skip were found was the same day that Chaney, Schwerner, and Goodman were killed.
Disappeared.
Yeah, disappeared. So sort of this confluence of things coming together.
Yeah, and I think what's fascinating about it is that, you know, that the ignorance of white people at that time, you know, was deep and cultural and had no idea. And these kids, and they were all kids. Like, if I really think about what it takes to motivate, you know, white college kids to do anything, it's obsession and feeling like they got to be part of something. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So the naivete of the music nerds, you know, versus the righteousness and sort of, the democratic thinking of the people that went down to march. Like, because I know these people. Like, they it's not that they're ignorant. They're just narrow. They're just kind of isolated.
That's right.
So these guys had no idea what they were driving into. They're just going, we're going to go find these guitar players.
Yeah, they just were on a musical mission.
Yeah,
you know,
based on nothing.
They didn't know anything.
The one kid, they got something from Bucca White who knows what he was even talking about.
That's right.
They go down
but
there.
But it was like a seed that made them say, wow, we can go on this journey, you know. And that kind of naivete is what, you know, helped them find these people, you know. I mean, and they weren't the only ones who were able to find people. Mississippi John Hurt was found like this.
Yeah,
I mean,
a couple years
before, right? Yeah, to bring back these iconic musicians who had done such phenomenal music.
Right, and I had no idea about that. And I like Son House and I like Skip James. I've read biographies of Skip James. But just culturally what was happening, it was very interesting to me, the detail about how most of that folk resurgence
was Irish folk music and British folk music and stuff that comes from that part of the world. And these guys had not even been recognized as being part of American folk music.
No, had not at all.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Now I'm just getting all excited. And the fact that there was actually a time where, you know, the guys who had these 78s, we're just sort of like, no one has these. This is magic.
Yeah.
You know, like, what
they
is
were jewels.
This? Right.
They were jewels.
You don't even think about that.
No.
These acts, these guys went to compulsively find, you know, defined, you know, rock and roll. They defined jazz. They defined everything.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just these nerds. And it just happened simultaneously. But I thought the balance of the respect for that art form and then the actual legislation that, you know, that happened within the 2 years of those kids being killed. Like what? Like when you come to this, and I know you work with Spike a lot, and you obviously have a history, and sort of like integrating these sort of separate, you know, actions of you know, kind of, you know, privileged white people being mm-hmm. pivotal, you know, in moving things forward. Yeah, how do you balance that? I mean, because there were guys that you talked to in the movie that were like, we got to get the rich kid, the white kids.
Yeah, I know. They're going to be fodder for the things happening.
Right.
I know. You know, it's an interesting kind of challenge as a filmmaker and as an African-American filmmaker to tell these stories and to, you know, you're basically putting these young white kids at the forefront of the stories. But the thing to remember is that they didn't do it out of kind of any sort of feeling like they were trying to make a name for themselves. They
right.
were trying to, you know, say, well, we can do this better than black people.
Right.
They did it because there was a lot of emotional and psychological sincerity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was sincere.
Yeah.
You know, when you have Dick and Nick Pearls and Phil Spiro and you have John Fahey and Henry Vestine, you know, and these guys searching for Skip and Son, it's sincere. When you have these other young white kids going down to be on the front lines, to know that their heads could be beaten in, you know, their arms could be broken, they could be killed, but they were still going down there because they believed they had to fight for these rights. It's a sincerity that's important to make sure this comes across, you know.
Yeah, and it's fascinating that, like just in you talking about what you lived through, is that this is before the late 60s where everything right. blows open.
It's the early 60s.
Right. So, you know, these are, you know, kind of real, these all these, the characters and the people that you talk about are real heroes of democracy in a way.
Exactly.
And it was not fashionable. It was not like, you know, we're going to grow our hair out. It was like, you know, this is a problem in our country.
Yeah, and we want to do something about it.
Yeah.
We want to do something about it, which is an important thing to remember. That kind of enthusiasm, that kind of naivete, you know, is what's galvanized people to support Bernie.
Right.
The same
absolutely.
Kind of attitude.
Yep.
And that's so important for a democracy like America, and particularly in these very turbulent political times.
Yeah. Where do you, like, because I, you know, where do you see, you know, the one thing a candidacy like Trump sort of reveals is just how much hostility and racial, you know, racist-driven anger there still is in this country. And they're willing to stand up and be identified if given the right, you know,
platform.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, you know, as a person who's 66 years old,
yeah.
you've seen a lot.
Yeah.
You would like to think that some of this stuff that you hear coming out of the Trump camp,
yeah.
you know, doesn't exist. But I knew it exists. I know it exists. You know,
yeah.
I'm not naive.
Right.
It just sort of saddens me that here we are 50 years later still
right.
going through this same kind of stuff. You know, it's just like, my God.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to change in the 60s and the 70s, but it hasn't, you know.
Yeah.
Because there's, you know, but that's what makes human beings. There's certain things that people emotionally feel, you know, angry about.
Yeah.
And they found a way to vent that anger now. They found the person who can help them voice that.
No,
anger.
I get that. You know? And you know, and it's broad-based anger. It's not all specific. It's
no.
just sort
broad-based.
Of like, yeah, I'm fucked, so fuck everything.
That's right.
Yeah, oh my God.
That's right.
So when you direct a documentary, because you've done producing, you've done directing, and you've done a lot of editing, the primary element is organizing, right?
There's two primary elements when you're doing a documentary,
yeah.
particularly like this one.
Yeah.
First is basically understanding what the concept is, which we knew as we developed it.
Uh-huh.
And then the deep dive is what I call importance in terms of historical documentaries, the research.
Right.
Really researching the subject that you're going to do.
Right.
In this case, what was going on in 64 in Mississippi? Who should we talk to? You know, who were these musicians? Now, me and Ben and David happen to know, we were familiar with Ten House and Skip.
Yeah.
So we had that handle, but we needed to understand what was going on in the civil rights movement.
Right.
Who should we talk to? You know, Bob Moses. You
right,
know.
Yeah,
should
yeah.
we talk to? Who should we talk to? Dave Dennis.
Yeah.
Who are those people we should talk to give us the inside story about what was happening down there? So, you know, understanding your concept, doing your research, and then deciding who you need to interview to help tell the story, and then what kind of material archivally in terms of photos, footage, newspaper headlines do you need to gather to help make that story visually come to life? And the other thing that's important, particularly for this documentary, a lot of times now people are thinking about, do we create reenactments? How do we make some stuff that we don't have, mm-hmm. like the guy searching for Son and Skip, how do we make it come to life? Now, one of the things that came up, and I think David was the one who thought about this, is that instead of doing reenactments,
yeah.
let's create animation.
Yeah, yep.
Let's do animation.
Sure.
Which, you know, we found a company in Europe that had done phenomenal animation. They did, Mark, they did a great
job. Oh, no, it's beautiful. And yeah. it's almost
and
got
it
like...
It comes to life.
Yeah.
It makes the film come to life. Because we didn't have anything else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So how do you do it? So animation was the key.
Well, yeah, your only other option is just a montage of stills.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, over and over again. And different pictures of John Fahey.
That's been done.
Or else you can do that thing where the guy comes out of the still and floats for a
that's
minute.
Right.
And then you put that...
That's been done
yeah,
to death.
Yeah. yeah. But I thought the animation was... It worked. It almost
really
had
worked.
An underground comic feel, like
that's
almost
right.
an R. Crumb vibe to it.
Exactly.
And the... I didn't realize that, you know, these stories, they're so tight, they're so close together. The coincidence, it transcends coincidence. I mean, when Ben was laying this story out to you and you were hesitant, when you saw the dates, were you like, that's some sort of kismet? That's like some sort of weird magical coincidence.
It amazed me. And I kept saying, we need to make sure and double check
yeah.
that it's correct.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's crazy.
Because it's crazy that it would happen. It's crazy.
And then, like, you know, when they found those kids, when they found Shaney Goodman and Schwerner, that, you know, that was within, what, you know, days of the legislation passing?
That's right. After they found the bodies, it was a few weeks after they passed
the Civil Rights,
Civil Rights Act.
Yeah.
The next year, there was voting right Act. Voting
right.
Rights Act.
But it took that. And then, like, that was the other thing that I think people forget, and that I always forget because I live in my own fucking world, is that, you know, there were people fighting hard
all the time
against those acts and those bills. They were like, this is not the way the South is good. That they had it in their head.
Oh yeah.
I see, because I don't, like, obviously I'm not African American, and you know, and in order for me to experience the proper amount of empathy, I have to watch a movie like this.
I know.
Because it's not my history.
But you know what's interesting though is that there's always these forces that are at play trying to untie the things that are happening.
Yeah.
I mean, specifically, look at North Carolina.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know,
horrible.
Look at it. You know, it's the governor there is trying to say, you can't be a transgender person and go into a men's bathroom if you think you're a man. There's always been these forces that are constantly saying, we want the status quo. We want to stay the same. We want things to not change.
Hmm.
That's why people are so grabbed onto Trump's, we want to make America great again.
It's already great.
You know,
yeah,
it's already great.
Yeah, and he forgets what's great about it. It's actually progress.
Right.
You know, moving forward.
Yeah, so it's always these forces, as you know, that are trying to undermine progress.
Right.
Constantly, constantly, constantly.
Right, but it's like, it's, I guess it's just based on, it's ignorance, but it seems deeper than ignorance because, like, I've been talking about this on stage a bit, that it seems that Americans fundamentally are relatively decent people, because once change happens, even if they were furious about that happening, within a couple weeks, maybe a year, they're like, I guess that's the way it is now.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they settle
they
into
adjust.
It.
They adjust.
Right.
They can adjust.
Yeah, because it didn't really have that much to do with their life anyways.
That's right.
Ugh.
You know, but you got to be able to say, okay, let's adjust.
Yeah.
But you know, and I know is, one of the things that's difficult for human beings is to deal with change.
Yeah.
You know?
It is.
On all levels. Change is, even me sometimes.
Sure.
Certain kinds of change in my personal life. I said,
yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, yeah. Don't take that away from me.
That's right.
That makes me happy, that
that's
thing.
That's right.
it was interesting too at the end that, to see that, you know, that Robert Moses and David Dennis continue to fight the fight.
That's important.
It is important.
That's an important thing to understand, that they didn't stop in 64. They understood that the mission, the journey is a long one, is a road that you got to keep constantly stay on.
Yeah.
And you got to, and these guys have my tremendous respect for being able to continue their fight.
Yeah.
I mean, here these two men are in their late 60s, early 70s, and they're still fighting the good fight.
Yep.
You know, and that's important.
And it was funny that the guys who, you know, the guys who were still alive, or that historically who the musicians and the music nerds, they went on to create a music label. One of them managed Sun House and Dick James.
Dick. Yeah. Dick became, I mean, listen, I don't know if you remember in the film where Sun House mentions Dick.
Yeah.
How important Dick is, very important to keeping Sun's legacy alive.
Still,
you know, today.
Yeah.
If you go to his house, he has a table full of pictures, and a lot of them of Sun House that he took himself. You know.
Yeah.
He is really a man who's kept that man's alive. When I did this blues documentary years ago with Scorsese as executive producer. That's when I first went down to Mississippi and met Dick. And
which one was that?
It was called the Blues Series. It was a seven-part series.
Yeah. I watched some of that. Yeah.
And the first one I did was Scorsese directed. And we went down to Mississippi to sort of follow the journey of the Mississippi music and where it came from.
Then right.
We ended up going to Mali.
Mali?
Mali, West Africa.
Yeah, West Africa.
Yeah.
Right. So you track the rhythms all the way back down
to Mali. Yeah. You know. And so that's when I first met Dick, you know.
Yeah.
I spent a whole day at Dick, talking about Sun and how he met Sun. So, you know, this was really great for me to go back almost 12, 13 years later
and spend
more time with Dick.
Sure. It's always good when people are still around.
I think Dick has something in common with you. He loves cats, man.
Does he? I got a few.
He has a lot of, he loves cats.
Yeah. Well, the blues is like, you know, I talked to another guy about that. That the thing about watching Sun House, and even in the footage that you had in the movie, which I think I had those on videotape. Those were Yazoo. Didn't they release some videos of Fuka White and Lightning and those guys?
Lightning Hopkins.
Yeah, I think I had them. But like that, these were not, the dialogue was not about race. Really,
no,
was it?
It's about love.
Yeah, and
love and lost, man.
Right, and but also, you know, God.
And God.
You know, like that thing about, you know, where I don't know if it was Dick who said that. No, it was the other guy. He said that Son had a hard time, you know, bringing together the God part and the blues part. So there's this struggle when that little key to Sun House, when you see him just singing a cappella or with the guitar, that he's doing something that he's not sure God would approve
of. That's right, because he's struggling inside with the forces of good and evil.
Right.
Constantly.
Really?
Good and evil.
Right.
And he's not figuring out. And you know, what's interesting, here's a man at that time in his 50s and his 60s still struggling.
Yeah.
You know.
Tap right back into it.
That's right. That's why he had to use that, you know,
drink the booze.
That,
yeah.
Booze all the time.
That's right.
Oh my God, who am I?
Yeah.
Who am I?
And he was like, and on some level, when you realize that these guys hadn't played in 20 years, that they got tired of the struggle. They were probably relieved. Like, all right, I'm just going to let this shit go. It might haunt them, but when these guys show up and say, let's bring you back to that.
Yeah.
You know, I assume that when Son got sick at Newport, it was nerves, right?
It was both nerves, but he had some intestinal problems.
Oh, yeah.
He had some intestinal problems.
That Newport footage, man, it made me cry. You know, the Skip James thing, you got Guralnick there. You know, and I've talked to him in here, you know.
Oh,
and he's,
Peter?
Yeah. And, you know, he's like, it was like he's seeing all these stars, and then Skip James gets on stage, erases everything.
Everything. Because, you know, his sound,
haunting.
His vocal sound is so haunting.
Oh,
so unique,
man.
And so special.
Mm-hmm.
He's so special. I mean, he really is one of the great, great blues musicians.
Oh, no, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So he must have been young when those guys...
He was young, you know, and after he did those recordings, you know, I think for him, spiritually, it was just too taxing and too emotional.
Yeah.
So that's why he walked away from it.
Yeah, because he's doing something more than just playing music.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, let's sit and dance music.
Well, that's the thing you got to remember about these blues musicians. It's always more than just playing music.
Yeah.
It's living. It's living and feeling. You know, internalizing the music. That's why these guys still are so iconic and so precious today.
Yeah.
You know, and for me growing up, you know, in New York City, it took me a while to really start to listen to the blues, you know. After I went through soul and R&B and Charlie Parker, then I came back to listening to the blues and said, whoa. you know.
Yeah, back to the source.
Yeah, I came back to, went right back to the source. When I first heard Charlie Patton, I said, whoa.
Oh, man, like Bo Weevil Blues. Yeah. And like, does that really? No. It's crazy, yeah. Man. And and the thing, the amazing thing about it is what you have to mentally kind of put aside just to hear the intensity of those performances still comes through those shitty records.
That's right.
Because even the best recordings sound like shit.
But, you know, that's what's so special about those analog records.
Yeah.
You're getting everything. You're getting the hiss.
Yeah.
Getting the noise.
I know. I'm back in it.
Yeah, that's what makes it so special.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, we got the digital stuff now, but in some ways, the digital stuff has homogenized the music.
No, no, definitely.
Cleaned it up in such a way that it just feels so, you know, clean.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you go back, you hear the hiss.
Oh, yeah.
You hear the hiss. You say, whoa.
Yeah,
it's the real thing.
So when did your relationship with Spike start?
It started in 1988. I was producing on a series called Eyes on the Prize about the civil rights movement up in Boston. And one day I was in my apartment and I got a phone call. My son, who was 10 at the time, picked up the phone.
Yeah.
And he said, "Dad, it's Spike Lee on the phone." And I thought he was pulling my leg. And I said, "Jason, don't pull my leg." You know, I said, "Dad, seriously, it's Spike." And Spike got on the phone. He had just finished Do the Right Thing. And he was getting ready to do a film about jazz musicians with Denzel and Wesley Snipes called which became Mo' Better Blues.
Yep.
And he had known that I was into the music from a production manager friend of mine that worked with him. And he asked me if I would edit Mo' Better Blues.
And why do you think it was, what did you bring to it by knowing about the music that he couldn't get to?
I don't, you know, he's pretty good on the music because his father's a jazz musician.
Right.
You know,
Bill Lee
is a great jazz musician.
Yeah.
So Spike knew the music. I think what I brought to it basically was an ally, a musical ally.
Oh, okay.
So when he said to one section of the film, he said, I want to use, and I said, Mingus's Goodbye Pork Pie Hat. And he said, yeah. You know, or All Blues, Miles is All Blues, you know, and so, and then at the end when we use Love Supreme by Coltrane, I was just in sync, because I play an instrument too. So
what do you play?
I play a little saxophone, a little flute.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so, and I studied music, so I know a little about music, so we were just in sync on the music.
Yeah.
You know? We were just in sync, because he's not a talkative man.
Spike?
No, he's not a talkative man, but he has very strong, visceral ideas that he knows how to get across.
Oh, definitely. You know? Yeah, because he's got a very unique way of working a camera.
Oh, he's learned to be, to me, one of the great film stylists.
Oh, definitely.
You know,
definitely.
He's got a great visual sense, and his politics is so strong throughout all of his films, you know.
Uh-huh.
You don't even have to agree with it, but it's there, it's in your face.
Yeah.
And that's what makes him so special and so unique.
Now, how many, you did a few movies. You did Jungle Fever with Spike?
I did Jungle Fever, Clockers, Girl Six.
Bamboozled. That thing, you know. That doesn't get enough credit, that Bamboozle.
Well, you know, it's one of those films that I think as it ages, it's going to become more and more relevant every day.
You know why I think that is?
Why?
Because the attention taken and put into the production value and the execution of the minstrel shows.
Oh, they were fantastic.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, they were fantastic.
Like, because, you know, you literally had to battle yourself while you were watching it to not be entertained at
all. That's right. It's walking a very thin line.
Right?
Very thin line. Because think about it. I mean, you just saw Shuffle Along. It was choreographed by Savion.
Yeah.
And he choreographed all those dance scenes.
Yeah.
In Bamboozle.
Elevated.
And they're fantastic.
Elevated.
They're fantastic. So part of you wants to say, wow.
It's great.
Part of you wants to say, ooh.
Right. I think that, like, to me, that blew my mind.
Yeah. But that's what Spike's all about, though. He never is going to give it to you so you say, oh, it's terrible. He's going to make it ambiguous.
Yeah.
So you as an audience say,
confronted.
How should I deal with this?
Yeah.
That's how he is.
He lets you do the thinking.
That's
and
right.
Wrestle with yourself.
He does every time.
And it's weird because, you know, people, like you said, like his politics are defined and they're they're hard hitting, but he's still going to, and I think that's what a documentary should do in general, right?
That's what they should do.
Right.
Yeah. They should force you as a viewer to think about where do you stand on this particular issue.
Right.
They shouldn't say, this is how you should feel. This is what it should be. Then they shouldn't be agitprop.
Right.
They should give you the perspective from different angles so you walk away as a viewer saying,
I don't know if that guy was a bad guy.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. He seemed like a bad guy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But he maybe not be 100% a bad guy.
Right. Yeah. So what do you think about this this kind of explosion of docs? Like, which is, you know, like, it just seems to be the new thing. It's like you talk to anybody, like, I'm working on a doc. Are you?
I think it's wonderful.
Yeah?
I mean, listen.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of these doc filmmakers who basically working with very little money. It takes them years to get these things done.
Yeah.
You know, but you have to applaud the stories they're tackling, the issues they're tackling. The fact that people, the general public, is understanding what a documentary does and is all about, and they're engaging in it, mm-hmm. you know, both on the small screen and in the big screen. I think it's great. I mean, I come up in a time when docs were just on PBS.
Right, that was it.
That was it.
Yeah.
Now you got them on Netflix, you got them on Amazon, you got them in the theaters. They're just coming out of everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think it's fantastic. Now, the reality is doc filmmakers don't make money.
Right. And some are better than others.
And some are better than others. But the fact that they're out there, I think it's great for docs.
And you're a documentary filmmaker. I mean, that's what you do. You're an editor, but primarily.
I'm a doc filmmaker, and I love documentaries. Now, you know, you think about, you know, talking about growing up in the 50s and the 60s.
Yeah.
I grew up watching Hollywood movies.
Yeah.
I grew up watching Burt Lancaster and, you know, and Kirk Douglas and Joan Crawford. And, you know, so when I got into the business, initially I thought I want to just make feature films. I want to edit feature films.
Did you? At the beginning, did you edit?
I worked as an apprentice on a low-budget feature film, but then the editor on that film introduced me to the world of documentaries.
Through what?
You know.
Through whose work? Like, what did you see first?
Well, the films that we were working on together, but then when I started to explore documentaries, I went to the work of Al Maisel's, the Maisel Brothers,
sure.
Salesman, mm-hmm. Gimme Shelter, you know, Penny Baker, you know, Robert Drew, who did Primary about the Kennedy family.
Right.
You know.
Did you ever see that Friedkin doc about the death row in prisoner that he, like, William Friedkin, I haven't seen it either.
I've never seen it.
His first experience was doing a doc for TV.
It was in Chicago.
Right, yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen it.
I haven't either.
You know, but then Michael Apted's 7-Up series.
Oh, yeah.
So when I started in my early 20s, when I got introduced to doc, I just fell in love with him.
Well, when you first got introduced to it, did you find that, was the alignment that you could educate and that you could further the dialogue about civil rights specifically, or just that you like docs?
Specifically, it was the fact that as an editor, I felt more empowered editing the doc than the feature film. Why? Because when you get a feature film, they give you a script.
Right.
They give you the scenes with the actors.
Yeah.
You know? And unless you're really a knucklehead, you know how to put it together.
Yeah.
You know, with a doc, 9 times out of 10, a director or a producer would come in and say, I have this great idea. I shot all this footage. I'm not sure how it should go together. I'm going to go away. I'm going to let you wrestle with it.
Yeah.
And I love that challenge.
Yeah.
At first, I was terrified of that challenge. Oh, my God. What if I fail?
Right.
But then I start to embrace it.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea of being sort of the director in absentia.
Yeah.
You know, being able to sit there and shape and mold the footage and give it rhyme or reason.
Yeah.
Became such a exhilarating feeling, even when I failed.
Right.
You know, it was like, wow, I helped make a film.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And I know David must have felt like that when she was doing this film, because she was a force in helping shape the direction of the story.
The editors they're almost all of it.
All of them.
It all happens with you guys.
Always. Yeah. Always. The truth of it, always.
Yeah, because like all you got, you're just hoping you got coverage.
That's
and
right.
And then you go to a guy like you and you go like, I think I got all the coverage. Put a rough cut together and then let's see what we got. Let's
see what we can make of it.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then it's sort of like, you got that other thing? I do.
That's right.
So when you started, you were cutting film.
I was cutting film.
Super. Oh my, I can't even imagine how long it would take.
It didn't take long because, it didn't really take long. It just took... It took a certain amount of patience to know when not to make a cut, because you didn't want to have a lot of little pieces.
Yeah.
So you had to be able to say when you were going to make a cut. It's sort of like, you know, Bresson, the photographer, is talking about the decisive moment.
That moment, yeah.
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 You had to have the same attitude when you used to edit film.
Right.
When was the moment to make the cut?
Yeah, you know? And you got to find it.
Yeah. At first, in the beginning, you would be sort of like, you know, should I make it here? It would take you 10 or 12 minutes to make a cut.
Right,
right. You got more experience, you could do it faster.
Right, oh, right. And yeah. I guess it's just like anything else, you adapt to the technology available.
That's right.
Now, like, when you do, like, when Spike does a documentary, right, did he do Four Little Girls?
He did Four Little Girls and When the Levees Broke.
Oh, that's the Real Levees Broke. You did that one too with him?
And the sequel, If God Is Willing and The Creek Don't Rise,
Who did the Emmett Till documentary?
Oh, that was Stanley Nelson.
That was a hell of a documentary.
Yeah, great filmmaker. Great filmmaker.
But when you do a documentary like Four Little Girls, which is, you know, a story that, you know, should be retold over and over again, that, you know, when Spike does something like that as opposed to a scripted feature, what's the dynamic between you guys?
The dynamic was a great one. You know, in that one, he said to me, I want you to be really engaged in this, not only as an editor, but as a co-producer. So when we went through the whole research process and finding the archival material, I went down with him on the first shoots, the first interviews and stuff. You know, he would have a particular strategy. Like, after we shot all these interviews, we would go into the editing room for like 2 or 3 weeks straight, like 7 in the morning, from 7 to 12, and just watch the interviews together and talk about what we liked, what I liked, what he liked, and we would do that through all the interviews. And then we would talk about, how do we see the film unfolding? One of the first questions Spike asked me when we were shaping the film, should there be narration? And I said, I didn't think so. I thought that the people of Birmingham can tell their own story, So the challenge was to how to make sure we told the story. And it was, again, sort of like what we did with Two Trains. It was to tell a story of these four little girls at the same time as we gave the audience the bigger context of what was happening in the civil rights movement at that time.
Right.
And to bring it together with that church bombing. Again, the confluence of ideas coming to the church bombing.
The horror.
And we were in sync with that.
Yeah.
So it was always this give and take with Spike and I on that and on When the Levees Broke.
And you know, I guess he's coming to you in that situation and the relationship you built as the guy with the experience.
Yeah, that I'd done a lot of docs.
Yeah.
You know, I did a lot of docs.
Did he like doing it?
He loved docs. He loves them.
Yeah?
He loves all kinds of films.
Yeah.
He loves making films.
And then the Levy documentary, to sort of, like, you know, really kind of isolate that narrative that, you know, through negligence or whatever, this is, you know, going to change the composition of that city and push, you know, the people that live there and built the history of it out, and they're going to let that happen.
Yeah.
So that was what had to be shown.
That's had to be shown.
Yeah.
And he, you know, again, he's not afraid to uncover and dig into every aspect of an issue.
Yeah.
And that's what makes those films work. That's what makes When the Levees Broke such a great film.
So what do you do with this movie now? What's the life of a documentary?
These films need exposure. You know, they need exposure. They need to go to festivals. They need to go to markets. They need to go any place where people can have an opportunity to see it. We also want to not only get, you know, distribution in the United States, but around the world. Any place that may feel the connection to this music, we hope that someone will buy it and show it.
Well, I love the movie, and you know, I wish you the best of luck with it. What does it take to get it on Netflix?
It takes somebody from Netflix watching that film and picking up the phone and calling Ben.
People need to not only, you know, rediscover or discover for the first time that music, but also to remain freshly aware of the struggle that is ongoing. It's like the Jewish thing. I'm a Jewish guy, and, you know, I'm not religious or anything, but that the never forget thing applies across the board.
Never forget.
So I hope that Two Trains Running gets distribution so everyone can see it. Hopefully it maybe ends up on Netflix or somewhere where you can watch it. It's good. It's very good. Roots music is definitely something at the foundation of the Handsome Family's sound. It was very exciting for me to talk to Brett and Rennie in Albuquerque at the Los Poblanos farm and ranch there where I stay. And I love their records. Their most recent album is called Unseen. It's available now. And this is me and Brett and Rennie Sparks, the Handsome Family, talking about music and depression and art and New York and stuff. All right, so listen.
Mm-hmm.
when I knew you lived here, I'm like, if I could go to their house, I pictured a gloomy place with a lot of things, maybe some carnival relics.
It's like that room that Van Gogh made for Gauguin with the enormous sunflowers all
right.
around it.
She's done that before.
How'd you end up in Albuquerque?
I'm from here.
You are?
Yeah, I grew up in the Southwest. I was born in Texas and grew up around.
Well, that's not that close.
Well, Panhandle.
Right.
Dust Bowl, Perryton, little tiny oil town.
In Texas.
My father worked in the oil fields.
Really?
So I grew up in Odessa.
Really? Ouch. No kidding.
Odessa,
so that's
Texas,
sparse.
Hobbs, New Mexico.
Hobbs. Yeah.
Last picture show territory.
It's a wonder I got out. Yeah. I spent every summer in a town right next to where the last picture show was shot in McInerney, Texas.
How close to reality was that?
Very. Too close.
So like
it's hard to watch.
So there was literally like, what, 150, 200 people in the town or more?
Oh, the town my mother grew up in, where my mother and father met, had a population of about 70.
Oh, my God.
They had a Baptist church and a Methodist church, a post office, and a bank.
And that was it?
And that was it.
But I thought the old men played checkers in the bank. They didn't actually, there wasn't any commerce going on in there.
No, they just played dominoes because the banks failed during the Depression. God. So it was just a shattered, burnout building where these old men just played dominoes.
Oh, my God.
This is real.
So when you were a kid, what was the dream? Just to get out? I mean, what the hell do you do? Like, I know that those towns existed in America, and I've driven past them, but I have no sense of, like, what do you do with the space in your mind? Well, I can hear it in your music now that you bring it up.
Yeah, it's there, and it's where I learned how to sing. I mean, in the Baptist church. I mean, I don't cling to those values anymore.
Well, that's probably good.
I mean, I just, you know, it's all these weird accidents happen to you, and I just kind of stumbled on classical music, and my mother started me playing piano when I was real young. Like,
so there was a piano
six
teacher
or so. Yeah,
there
was
a good piano teacher.
There was a really good piano teacher in Odessa, Texas.
That can be a lifesaver, just
and
one person
started,
in town.
That's right, right? Yeah. It's true.
Started really getting into Beethoven and Chopin and
really?
Bach and all that stuff, and I started playing music. And then
started
I was
getting
like,
beat up regularly.
Yeah, I started getting my ass kicked like every day in Odessa, Texas.
By the riggers.
By the jocks.
Rigger kids.
Well, I'm Odessa, Texas. That's Friday Night Lights territory.
Right.
That's Mojo. Permian high
school. So you were sort of the nerdy music kid?
I was beyond nerdy.
Yeah. There's an album title.
I was the object of derision.
You were the one.
Totally.
There was no other. There was no crew. There was no support.
There was a crew. There was Darren, and there was some other dorks. You know, big, tall, lanky.
Yeah.
Guy, red hair, you know.
And then where'd you grow up?
I grew up on Long Island, so the chances of our meeting were pretty slim.
Which town?
I'm from Smithtown on Long Island on the East Shore.
Yeah.
So, on the North Shore, sorry. I haven't been there in a while. But, I'm New York Jew, no connection to Texas or Mexico whatsoever. Couldn't understand a word he said when he showed up in New York. It was like he spoke another kind of English. We had...
So no,
that
was
probably
was
the
great.
Attraction.
My daddy is like, you know, hello, you know, and her father is
just
like,
translated
I
all
can't
night.
Understand a word. Forget it.
But so you went to New York and you met her there. When did you start in the music?
Well, this is so sad. He went to Long Island to SUNY Stony Brook, where I was going to college, thinking, because it's 60 miles from New York, but it's Long Island, which is a long 60 miles from Manhattan.
Yeah. It's another world.
So he went there thinking, well, 60 miles in Texas isn't very far, so he'd be right outside of the city.
It's true.
But it was a
dust
bowl.
You went there for college?
Yes, graduate school.
In what?
Music history.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you
not
finish?
Not even apply. Yeah, I have a master's degree.
You have a master's degree in music history?
Yeah.
Well, that's impressive. You could...
Well, that's okay.
Oh, yeah. It's like gravy train.
Well, it's like... Yeah, I spent, 7 years just not even... It's not even playing music. It's thinking about music.
Right.
And writing music and looking at the way it, you know, unrolls over time.
But that informs something.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to do it.
Yeah.
I didn't
have
really
any plans.
I was, when I went to UNM, where I graduated from, you know, they were always trying to encourage people, oh, you'll never get a job doing this.
Yeah.
So you should go into music education. And I was right. like, I don't want to be a fucking band teacher.
the drunky kind of like angry dude trying to get a bunch of freshmen music.
Yeah, now we're going to learn Rite of Spring.
That's right.
1, 2, 3, 4.
What's that like? What's that, that song? That
Baby Elephant Walk.
Baby Elephant Walk.
Right, right, right.
Mancini.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's a marching, it's like always a stage band number.
It's awesome.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. So... You're not making music, or you are when you go to graduate school? You went to UNM here.
Oh, yeah. I started, I went to UNM and I did all kinds of music. Most of it kind of weird, avant-garde.
What year?
I graduated at 1200? From there in 85.
From UNM.
So I went to New York in 86.
Really? Yeah. So you were doing like noise music? And
it was also in a new wave band that I wrote all the songs for. It was a real new wave.
What band? Just you?
There's a band called Sleep. There's a band called Sleep, strangely enough, from Albuquerque that's actually very popular. They tour internationally.
But that was your band in the 80s, your art rock band?
It had nothing
band?
To do with me, but that was the name of my band, yeah.
Right. They took it later.
It was probably just some weird zeitgeist or something.
I knew a guy who did experimental music that when I was in high school changed my life. This guy, Steve LaRue, and he had a band called Jungle Red that played twice a year.
This sounds kind of familiar.
It's just him and another dude who I think has since passed. Hmm. And they would it involved there was guitars that were taped with duct tape and hit during the show. There was pottery breaking. Fiesta ware destroying.
Oh, so this is an avant-garde wear. Situation.
Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. People like that can change your life. Yeah,
they do.
They
man.
Really do.
So who sort of? And what was your musical background?
The Ramones. That's all. They were just a local band I saw every weekend. You know?
Did you go? Yeah. You were part of it?
Yeah. I had no concept that there was a punk rock movement. It was just we all liked the Ramones and the New York Dolls.
The Ramones when they were like, you know, their audience was like girls and before. There was a mosh pit.
Like in the mid-70s?
Yeah, and then I remember going to London in like the early 80s and seeing somebody with the Ramones, one of their albums painted on the back of their jacket, and I was like, oh my God, it's somebody from Long Island. It never occurred to me. Someone else might have heard of the Ramones. So it's like, you from the island?
No. Well, it's interesting how that whole time that... Like how much the American thing did inform the British thing. Like I've only put that together recently. I just talked to Legend McNeil a couple of weeks ago because they reissued a new edition of Please Kill Me, which is the greatest book ever written. But I talked to Chrissy Hynde. I've talked to people about that when the Heartbreakers showed up in London, it was like a huge game changer when Johnny Thunders and those
that's great
junkies.
Oh, yeah.
But you were watching them when you were a kid, basically?
Yeah, you know, it was just, that was local music. And
you go into the city.
Yeah, you go to, you know, you take the train into the city, and then, you know, you get the 5 a.m. train back, and you say you slept over your friend's house, and here you are.
You used to see them on Long Island. Like,
yeah, there was a lot of clubs
my father's
all over
place and Long like Island, just yeah. weird little
Yeah, it was
clubs.
Really a sad moment when suddenly these guys with skinheads showed up and like pushed us girls to the back of the room, but these were our boyfriends for a long time. These were people we just loved.
It was because it was just rock and roll at that time. Before
Joe Ramone, I mean, he did some really, really pop, beautiful, sweet songs. We were all in love with him.
And he's so like I just watched some stuff. I just watched a documentary on Danny Fields, and they had a lot of footage of Joey dancing and stuff. And he was so sweet.
It's pretty lovable.
Yeah, it is. It's.
I once saw him and his father at Veselka eating soup opposite each other. And it was just so cute because they were just having lunch, but the profile was the same. Just a little Joey Ramone dad.
Amazing.
So, did you play in rock bands then?
I played bassoon.
What?
I don't know why. I think I wanted the oboe, but I said the wrong name, and then I wasn't too embarrassed to take
it
back.
But this is starting to make sense, though, with his education, and then you played bassoon, and this sort of like kind of weird, dense, you know, almost... atmospheric music you do now, it kind of lends itself towards your skill set.
Maybe so. Maybe there's some sense to it. But no, I just wanted to have a boyfriend who was in a band. Maybe that was like the height of dreams I had.
When we met in college, we definitely had record collections that
Yeah, we went to see a lot of bands together.
Venn diagram, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, you got the Meat Puppets, cool. It's
yeah,
like,
which one?
Oh, you get the Minutemen. Up on the Sun.
Yeah,
Meat Puppets 2, of course.
I talked to Kirk.
Oh yeah,
we toured with him. Yeah, we, that was interesting.
They are interesting.
Yeah,
because they amazing. They don't commit to any sound. Other,
yeah,
they just do what they want.
Yeah, yeah, they're just
not a lot of people do that.
No,
they're fearless.
They're kind of into it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think that's great.
Trippy shit.
Yeah. And I felt like when I was in his presence, we were like in another dimension. Like that was Kirk's dimension.
He's definitely one of his, he's one of those guys.
Yeah.
He's got his own time zone.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, he's seen it all.
Well, what other stuff were you guys going to see? Like what other records?
Butthole Surfers.
We used to go see Butthole Surfers. And we used
Noisy
to go
bands.
To CBGBs. And,
really? You like those guys, huh?
Yeah.
I think you
maybe played me one of your dad's 8-tracks of Patsy Cline, and I was sort of, that was it. I was ruined.
Well, there was that time like when everything kind of collapsed, like before the whole indie rock explosion, like before Nirvana.
Yeah.
Like, and after punk was definitely dead, and post-punk was even dead. There was this period that really sucked, and everyone was kind of casting around for something to listen to. And then, you start listening to your dad's old Hank Williams and Patsy Cline stuff, and you're like, this is the shit.
Right.
This is the same thing.
Yeah.
You know?
And
I know that's a cliche and everybody says it, but
I don't know
first
if it's
time
a cliche.
I heard Hank Williams, I was like,
but it's a road that leads backwards forever.
Right.
So it's
only cliche to this small community of people that would consider it a cliche. To most normal people, or not normal people, mainstream people, it's like, you listen to who?
Yeah, yeah. Like you mean Bo Sivas?
Right.
I think there's generations of people over and over again who find Hank Williams, who find like the Harry Smith anthology of American folk music, things that are these like gateposts that open up worlds to people. But over and over again, people find them and think they're the only ones who's ever heard this. But we all end up just on this time travel backwards and backwards.
You know,
it's never ending. Like I'm just now starting to get into like I listen. I'm back buying vinyl. You got vinyl?
Yeah, of course.
And like these those Tammy Wynette records, the George Jones records, and the Patsy Cline records, and then these folk records. That guy Hurley, is his name Mike Hurley? Do you know that guy?
No.
Yeah, he's a guitar player.
Yeah,
yeah.
That first album on Young Folkways,
I don't know that.
Was like destroying.
I don't have that record yet.
Burt Jansch, I just started listening to.
Oh, he's great. Yeah.
Then
you get into all that Scottish, British Isles kind of stuff. That
next
stuff
thing you
awesome.
Know, you'll be looking at 16th century broadsides
thing.
Trying to read the music.
We've gone down.
I got it.
Ready
we've
now.
Gone down that rabbit hole, you know, with the whole English folk thing.
Yeah,
Martin Carthy and
trying to trace some of these folk songs backwards. It goes forever, and it goes across. You know, it goes into other countries and
then comes
Scandinavia.
Here through Appalachia.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, right.
Appalachia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
And it must be here from the Revolution. I mean, it must
Scots
have come,
Irish.
Yeah.
From
and
Ulster.
You can hear it all through the country music.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's wild, man. You know
it
what else
wild.
Fascinates me
it's
is
true.
The accordion in Mexican music comes from the Germans.
Right.
And Polish,
why were the Germans in Texas?
They were because...
This is good.
Not a very nice story, but the Mexican government paid Germans, Western Europeans to come. You can come have some
Texas
land
asses.
If you agreed to kill some Indians. So basically they were like...
So it's a military thing.
Kill some Apaches, you can have a farm.
So they were kind of like...
Yeah, so these
the
Germans
Southwest.
And Poles and a lot of Europeans came and were Mexican citizens. And then they decided, well, we've killed all the Apaches. Now let's kill the Mexicans and become our own country. And that's kind of why Texas wanted its independence. But they became part of America. And so that was what the Alamo was kind of about too.
Remember?
Oh my God! See, like I'm glad you're teaching me history.
A
lot of people in Texas
reader.
Will tell you, "Oh yeah, my family used to be Mexican citizens," because they think that maybe they have some kind of Spanish roots, but really it's just that their families agreed to
to come over and kill Indians.
Sure. Well, and you know there was money for scalps too. That was when the Mexican government was giving money for any dark-haired scalp, so that was kind of a bad thing.
Even Mexican indigenous people.
Well, if you found a long-haired, dark, black-haired scalp, you could get money for it.
Wow.
That wolf pelts were pretty good commerce back then.
Right. Because well, there's that bit in, which Peckinpah movie is it? The Wild Bunch? Where the Germans bring the cannons?
Yes.
Right. But that's where all where all the polka came from.
Yeah,
yeah, that's amazing.
Mexicans
yeah.
did some good stuff with that music.
Great, amazing. Yeah. So, all right. So you're not in bands. You're playing bassoon.
Yeah. She was writing.
I was always wanted to be a writer, which, you know, another worthless pursuit in a lot of ways. But
come on now.
Didn't know what to do with it. You know, just
but you do write now. You have books.
Yeah, I do.
Well, she writes all the lyrics.
Yeah.
All the
I don't write any lyrics.
No? You're the music guy?
I come from a long history of, I think, you know, dark storytellers. So
that's the thing about, like, because I think at least a few records I listen to, I don't know, I don't go back to the 90s with you guys, but they seem to be concept records in that they're whole pieces.
I hope so.
They're records instead of albums.
Right. And they, you know, the last one was, is that the one in the box?
Yeah, with the animals, yeah.
Oh, my God.
People kept asking me if it was a children's record, though, so it got a little confusing, but it is not a children's record.
It would be one of those children's records that's a life changer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she wanted it to be like fair, a medieval bestiary, but one of the things everybody's that, like, oh, it's a kid's record.
One of the things that informed my childhood was my parents, they had two sets of records. We had either Jewish comedy records.
You know, Alan Sherman.
Alan Sherman, Tom Lehrer, we had folk music, like from the 50s in Greenwich Village. So they had they had Peter, Paul, and Mary, and they had the Kingston Trio, and they had Burl Ives, and they put those records on for me to go to sleep to, thinking of them as very calming records. But if you listen to the lyrics to those songs, they're usually quite terrifying songs. So yeah, I made the mistake.
Burl's a little haunting, man.
Yeah, Burl is.
Like, I kind of remember him from variety shows when I was kid.
That voice is quite otherworldly, and those songs that he sang were always about, you know, little things happening in the woods,
bad swimming in the water. Yeah.
But and then he, you know, even the whole story of Burl Ives is even scarier, because he was the one who testified before like some Senate committee that Pete Seeger was a communist.
He's a namer of names.
So then he became a sort of persona non grata in the book.
So he kind of gets swept to the side by.
And then Pete Seeger, but so that's really the difference between sort of populist, you know, music about issues, and then fairy tale music.
Yeah, it is like Burl. I was saying a lot of fairy tale music is what I would say, and I think you know, you say you
fuck your mind up.
Well, I feel like I've kind of found Burl Ives again in my life, so I was looking for him.
Oh, thanks a lot.
No, in a beautiful way. He's everything to me. That was when I shaped everything about my life. Was late at night listening to those Burl Ives records and just frozen in fear. You know, the kind of terror you can only have when you're a little kid and you can't move. You're so terrified of the songs.
Oh, so they really hit you like that. Because, like, that was, you know, that's what fairy tales were.
Yeah.
They were these portals into the dark, morally slippery universe of humans.
Yeah, they can open up doors that maybe you don't expect.
Do you remember a song that just made you go like, oh, shit?
Oh, what's the little black bug?
The little black bug.
Yeah, the little black bug swimming in the water. That one's quite terrifying. But even like On Top of Old Smokey, the ones that, you know, My Darling Clementine, those songs are really terrifying.
Horrible. People die in them.
Yeah. And, you know, like My Darling Clementine, not only is she drowning, but her father's watching her going, sorry, dreadful sorry, but I ain't coming in there to get you. You look so pretty when you're drowning.
Yeah, those songs have become muted over time and don't have that.
I know. Because
until you really look at them, it's like, whoa.
But they've got to connect with you on that level.
Yeah, they
and
do.
They did you. Like, yeah. I mean, like, I know those songs kind of, but I don't register them in that same way. Yeah,
we're not supposed to anymore. We're supposed to just enjoy the pretty melody, but I made the mistake of listening.
I think that was always the point on some level. I don't think they were made to terrify children.
Certainly not. My parents wanted me to go to sleep. They didn't want me up in their room screaming at night about things under the bed. They wanted, you know.
I wonder what the intent was. Why those stories? I think that must come from the sort of like English and Gaelic tradition of living a hard life.
Some of them were like newspaper stories. They were about actual events.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
commemorate an event.
I feel like there may have been a theory that if you terrify the child enough, they'll be too scared to get out of the bed. So that could have worked as well.
Or maybe it's more like, you know, buying a pet so the kid will learn about death.
Yeah,
like, you know, buy the kid a gerbil.
I'm not telling my kid about death, but listen to this record. Exactly. And I'll come back in an hour and see how you're doing.
Exactly. Life is hard. here's a fun way to learn that.
Yeah, we need that now, you know?
Yeah. And it is important. Kinda. You know, I think kids need to.
Yeah, do you feel like you're on a mission?
Yeah, well, I mean, I wouldn't say that, but I do think that we have a strange reluctance to discuss mortality in America, as if we just don't say it, it won't happen. But
we hide old people.
That's not the case. Yeah, and, you know, we're very, we're not even death, but old age, we're afraid to even you know, say anything about. So
yeah, well, there was a time where, you know, where people...
Grandma used to die in the living room with everybody around her,
in a bed, the hospital bed.
Right.
Do you have that in your life?
No.
That must have been small town, though. I mean, how did people die in Odessa, Texas?
Well, Odessa was bigger, but yeah,
you'd
in a
playing
small
dominoes
town,
in the bank,
yeah,
and just keel over.
You'd go look at him in the church, you know, and then you'd carry him to the graveyard, which is 200 yards away, and you'd put him in the ground.
When did you start making music together?
We were married for 5 years before we ever wrote a song together.
And you were playing your avant-garde
music? I was
music?
Always doing my thing. Oh, I was playing in pop bands in Chicago. And
you had a good heavy metal
played
band.
In rockabilly bands.
When did you get to Chicago?
We moved to Chicago. She went to graduate school in Ann Arbor for creative writing.
Oh, that's
Cha-ching.
A good town.
Yeah. It was a good town.
And it's good for that. It's a good program
it's
for
good
that.
Music history there. And it's a nice college town. There used to be a pretty good comedy club there.
Yeah.
It was a nice town. It was an easy town to be a kid in.
Good record stores.
Only so much trouble you could get into.
Yeah, it's a college.
Yeah.
But we wanted to live somewhere a little realer, and Chicago was as real as it got back then.
I like Chicago.
Yeah, I love Chicago.
It's a great place to
home.
It's a great place to try to be an artist. It really is.
We're going
really encouraging place. Yeah.
How so? Because I talked to a lot of people from the comedy world, but I haven't talked to anybody really about the music world of Chicago.
Well, when we lived there in late 80s, early 90s, it was just sort of deserted. So you could get your own huge warehouse space and open a theater. You could, you know, have a band practice there. You could do whatever you wanted. Nobody really cared. So it was great sort of...
A lot of raw space.
Yeah, we would just go to people. Everyone had a loft space, and everyone was just doing their thing there, and it was really, really exciting.
So you had one of those sort of like, home slash loft slash performance environments.
Yeah, it was a dump. It was 3,000 square feet, and it was $500 a month.
And you didn't have shows. You had parties. Where people
there were parties and shit. They were happening. Thank God.
Yeah.
You just leave the door open and see if people come.
They were parties.
And who was it, like? Who were some of the people on the scene there? Anybody that kind of transcended?
Like, hey, look, Liz Phair's here.
Yeah.
Well, when all that stuff was coming up, it was like Liz Phair, Smashing Pumpkins, Serge Overkill, and Lounge Axe was like in full effect with the Club Tweedies.
Great bands from Drag City.
Everybody Grill in Drag Jockey. City played there. The Palace played there on a regular basis.
Bloodshot Records, regularly. All those bands.
All that's the insurgent country stuff was coming up. At the time, too, Bloodshot just got founded. I mean, it was a really fun.
I get a lot of records from Bloodshot Records. There's definitely a context there.
Yeah.
The Americana kind of.
Yeah. We're all friends, and we contribute usually to their, compilations and stuff.
Oh, you do?
But
and Jeff Tweedy seemed like he was really inspiring to so many people. He was sort of
Jeff
helping a lot of people.
A big factor in our lives.
He was then?
Yeah.
That was how we met him.
Oh, really?
It was in Chicago, yeah.
And did you work with him?
Yeah, and he loaned us a lot of equipment.
I think his wife passed a demo to him.
His wife ran Lounge Axe, which was the great club in town. And so, through her, we met him, and a lot of bands met him. And he just was so helpful to everybody. Anybody he could help, he did. And he gave a lot of people great support slots, and he gave us all the equipment we used for our third record. He lent us
for Through the Trees,
to use.
And he's
so
on Through the Trees.
For 6 months, we got all this equipment we could have never afforded. So
but
really
initially, where was Wilco at that time? What year are we talking about?
This was the beginning.
Yeah.
So, but he already set
up shop
there.
We've supported Uncle Tupelo, so we knew him back then.
I loved Uncle
Tupelo. Yeah,
I just met Jeff for the first time.
Yeah, he's a great, smart guy. And so right after Uncle Tupelo, when they'd broken up, he was kind of, I think he was sort of like, we knew he'd formed another band, but nobody'd heard it yet. And,
AM just
and then,
had come out.
Sunbowl came out, and they were really doing well. And we thought, oh, poor Jeff. Well, I hope he's going to be okay. He landed on his feet.
He did all right.
He sure did. He's okay.
I know what you mean.
You don't have to worry about him. He's
and
got
Jay
enough people following
kind
him.
Of kept doing his thing. And, and he kept doing it. And he kind of stayed in that
But yeah, that's
place.
What happens. It's weird.
And that's cool. I mean, it, on every record, there's some stellar songs.
Like, I don't really understand people that stay in a groove if it's not working and they're not being forced to stay in that groove by a record company to be redundant. Like, you know, that... I mean, I understand, I guess if that's the music you play, there's a dedication to
it. People do what
it.
They do. You
exactly.
Know, I think
you can't...
You don't really...
It takes a lot of guts to go all
over
the place.
Well, I think a lot of people
do
what
go all over the place.
Think
Some people,
they're expected to do, too, which is kind of a bugaboo.
Yeah, but who's expecting you to?
I don't know.
Your audience. Right. It's like, I need more up-tempo songs on this record.
I don't know.
Because it's going to be boring.
I don't think anybody thinks about that anymore.
I'm going to lose my alternative country fans if there's not enough honky-tonk numbers on
it. I guess that's true.
I don't do that anymore, but I used to.
Yeah, you don't do it anymore?
I don't think about that anymore.
Yeah, record sales aren't important anymore. So.
Well, I know. Well, that's it.
That's very true.
The people you're playing to, you're inventing them, first of all. They're in your head, usually. Right.
That's true.
You know, if there is guys that are thinking like you, who the fuck needs them?
Right.
Like, you know, those four people that are like, sold out, huh?
there is no selling out anymore.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, yeah, but that's like if you have a certain type of brain that's insecure or dark, that, you know, instead of going like, we're doing new things and this is great, you're going to be like, no, that one dude, Stu, is going to be upset.
He's going to be pissed if I don't have the ding, 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 you know.
I mean, this any kind of creative life is so hard to navigate and survive in that you might as well do what gives you joy because there's no other reason
to do it. It's like you find your voice over time, though, and
you
then you stop worrying about shit like that.
You do.
And you say, this is what I'm doing now.
Yeah, I'm surprised.
And you make a decision and you carry on.
Yeah, I'm surprised that there are definitely waves of insecurity that continue to come.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I don't think that ever ends.
It's crazy. I mean, it just pivots,
as they say.
Everyone I've ever been jealous of and when I've met them and talked to them, they're always just as trembly as I am.
Oh, yeah,
it never ends.
They're all fucking nuts and they hate themselves and they're having a hard time.
Yeah.
It's sort of like this disappointing, it's a disappointing moment when you realize you wasted all that energy assuming
when I get to there.
This person is having an amazing life and you meet them, they're like, oh, I'm at the end of my rope.
Yeah, it kind of made me love all my idols even more, realizing that we're all just doing this because this is what we want to do. There is no
idols though did you get to meet where you were sort of
Lou
like,
Reed I think was one especially that you know, he was somebody I thought, well, what if I was ever Lou Reed, everything would be okay, but he had problems obviously just like anybody else. And you know, we played some big shows with him, we did some Leonard Cohen shows with him where we were all doing Leonard Cohen songs, so we spent a lot of time backstage because we were all doing like one or two songs, so talking to him and just
talking about nothing,
just a sweet you know, generous,
because you don't go up to Lou Reed,
gentle man.
Oh, was he,
man? Yeah. I'm your biggest fan, you know, because when somebody comes up to you, I mean, it's nice and you appreciate it, but when people come up to you and say, oh, I love you, man, I love you, blah blah blah, it's like there's a little spark in you that says, well, that's cool, I'm the shit, but you know, you've heard it and it's like, this doesn't really,
doesn't
really advance the plan at all.
And then you got to be gracious. You go from like on the ship.
That's cool,
to like,
man. Thanks.
When Nick Cave,
I did the same thing. I asked him about a question about what are those bells on
Nick Cave?
Let Love In, you know? And he's oh, yeah, we had this big thing in the studio.
He's excited.
The first thing. Yeah. So it's like, yes, people, something, you know.
So Nick Cave and Lou Reed. Now we're getting into the area.
That's the idol area.
Yeah.
Now we're getting into the tone.
There's like a transcendent grace in this music that isn't in the person when you sit down and talk to them in everyday life. They're not shining. They're not glowing.
They're the vessel.
They're just.
Well, they might be an asshole. They might just be a racist.
Yeah, regular guys.
Right? Yeah. I remember hearing recently, I heard Loretta Lynn on a show for a record she had just put out, and they started talking to her about politics. And I was
careful.
Like, don't do it.
Careful.
Well, because like, I didn't, like, of course she's going to be who she's going to be.
Sure.
She comes from where she comes from.
Of course.
But it's sort of, and it didn't necessarily even taint her for me. You know, like I would have assumed as much. But
sure. It makes it more mysterious, though, I think, in a way.
If you don't talk about it.
No, I think I'm saying when I hear the person and I realize they're just a person that isn't extraordinary in any way, shape, or form.
Except for the gift.
Except when they do this one thing where suddenly the world takes on another dimension.
I use music as a drug in a way. Like it's taken me just getting older to get into the depth of even listening to lyrics. Like I like, you know, I like a hook. I like,
you like a more visceral thing. So
I do.
So Leonard Cohen's a lot more intellectual, maybe.
Well,
I'm
getting there with some of these folk singers now. Yeah, but I still have
you
to
You
want to
feel
attention.
It in your gut first. And I think.
I definitely do.
I want to feel it in my heart first. So maybe it's like the emotion comes from me, words first. So.
Well, sometimes like I'm
like, going top down and you're going bottom up.
Yeah, I guess so.
But we can meet in the middle occasionally.
Sure.
So that's what's kind of interesting.
That's definitely it. But like, when did you make the first record? The late 90s?
Early 90s.
Early 90s, 93, 94.
And that wasn't like the records you're doing now, though.
That was kind
of,
wandering around
then.
In the forest.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well,
but not defining the forest.
the seeds were definitely there of what we were going to do later, but there was a lot of, shit on there, too.
noise.
It's an interesting document, but it's kind of like, and it was recorded well, but it's like that we were under the influence of a lot of Seattle kind of bands.
And you were like mentally different.
Yeah, there's definitely a premedication, post-medication.
pre-bipolar experience.
You were bipolar your whole life and you didn't know it, or did it get worse?
That's when I...
It gets worse.
That's when it...
No, I know, my old man.
It came to a head.
You get caught when it gets worse. You know?
The year after that, 1995, was when it reared its head.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
To where it was tangible?
Untenable.
He got locked up.
Where I couldn't function, basically.
They came out with the big
net. Where I was a danger to myself and others.
Really? Was it a mania or was it a depression?
It was mania.
Oh, you don't get arrested for depression. Busted. It's the mania that's going to get you locked
depression.
Up.
Yeah. The mania is what gets you, yeah.
And how grand was it?
I was committed to a state facility.
For what action? What did you decided that made people go, maybe he needs help?
It was a combo. It was combo number five.
Yeah.
It started out when you drew that little
I was real
pencil
belligerent.
Mustache.
I kind of assaulted a big security guard kind of person.
Oh, yeah.
In the Mag Mile.
Oh, yeah.
This is in Chicago.
Yeah.
I was driving around my car. Drinking champagne and eating cat food.
Totally jubilant.
I don't know why.
You didn't have to eat cat food. No.
It was easy. It was convenient.
You didn't have time to make a sandwich.
And I was at a place where I thought feeding my body, obviously I've gotten over that, that was a nuisance and a distraction that I could no longer deal with.
So you had a system.
I was going to consume only what I needed to stay.
Enough
float.
For a small kitten.
And I was drinking that black, you know, champagne that comes in the black bottle.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Cheap shit, Freshenet. They sell it wine
in,
you know.
Yeah. What is
and
that?
So I was at Freshenet.
And you were building a portable recording studio in the car.
Freshenet.
A portable recording studio in the car?
In the car, yeah.
So I think you were not
got big plans.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a lot of big plans.
You had a lot of diagrams around the house with electricity
enough,
and pyramids.
I was listening
to
Daniel Johnston, too.
Yeah, pyramids and electricity, schematic diagrams?
Yeah, he had some things figured out.
A beautiful mind. I was working on another level.
Some kind of like psychic battery.
It was weird because every now and then I would hit on something that would be pretty
dolphins and pillows and very strange
but
connections.
Most of the time it's just gibberish.
Yeah.
And then you get to this place where, you know, like you just talked
and you guys are married
just
at this time.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with this.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
You thought maybe he does have something.
Well,
maybe.
I mean, the pyramid could be a battery. How am I can't argue with that.
Look at this thing about teepees and reverse cones and vortexes. And
also crucifixes were electrical.
And crucifixes, positive and negatives.
Sure,
there was some physics involved that wasn't completely crazy.
He created a personal Kabbalah.
On top of everything, I was drinking a lot and doing drugs that were misprescribed.
I think you were prescribed antidepressants, and that wasn't.
They were giving me antidepressants, and
they don't take it down.
That was just taking me over the edge.
Yeah, it may have been a mistake, but
so I was fucked up.
Yeah, were you making any music?
That's the thing. I mean, people have this.
You don't get a lot of work done in that phase of life.
You got diagrams.
Since
to make.
I made this public, you always get this thing. Oh, you must get a lot done when you're. You don't get anything done.
You don't.
And it's this. It's like you mentioned Byron. It's like this whole, you know, fiery genius, crazy, crazy diva. Who? Yeah. That's a dangerous ideology to me. My advice is. Take your meds.
You're right, especially if you're the only one that thinks that.
Yeah. Right, because when you're
mental hospitals are not full of artists.
They're full of really tortured people.
Yeah,
and it's hard to get work done when your brain is totally disconnected.
Do you remember the elation of it?
Oh yeah,
yeah. And so you were in the hospital for a while.
2 weeks, yeah.
And they got you level.
Yeah.
Well, he kept saying to me, he seems like he's, you know, pretty rational, but he keeps talking about that he's going to tour Europe with his band. I was like, no, that one's actually true. The rest about the batteries and the pyramids isn't
true. I've got to get out of here, Doc. I'm supposed to go to a tour of Germany. And it was like, he's clearly still delusional.
That was the real part.
That's Catch 22 situation.
So now you have a new record coming out?
We do, yeah, September 16th.
It's going to be in a big, pretty box?
Yes, I hope so. Yeah, the LPs are on their way. I would have brought you one, but we will
Vinyl's
send you one.
Vinyl's getting hard to do lately.
We got a transparent green vinyl on the way, but
everybody's doing it.
Very slow. Those vinyl factories are way back up.
Yeah, see-through green vinyl.
Yeah, it's pretty. I like. Yeah, I'll get one. So how many records did it take? So the first record was post you being properly medicated?
No, before. We had two before.
Two pre-medication records.
Yeah.
And then after you leveled off, was that when you sort of found the groove that you kind of built on?
I think medication, without it, we wouldn't have a band. We wouldn't have a marriage. For both of us, I'm on medication too, so it's not just him. I mean,
well, that's nice. You know, and you can have something to do together in the morning.
We shop for pill cases together. That's right.
You buy pill boxes, yeah.
And, I think it's important to realize that, medication can save people's lives.
No, absolutely.
There's some really amazing drugs out there. Not all of it is necessary, but for us, it's been the difference between life and death, for sure.
And you can function, and if you don't romanticize the madness.
Yeah.
Well, that's the hardest thing, I think, for the bipolar thing, is like you like the manic.
Yeah, but...
kind of miss it. I'm nostalgic
but
for this.
But he got far enough into it where it wasn't fun anymore. Scary. Well, you were on fire.
It's like the waves are like this. Small waves.
The roller coaster wasn't fun anymore.
Instead of like this.
Right. I get it. It's days.
I still have mood swings.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're always going to be bipolar.
Essentially, it's about the work, too. I mean, when you make a record, it's not... I mean, and I record I write the music, I record it, I basically play almost everything. So it's like, this is work. This is not some
pie in the sky nonsense,
you know?
And you've got fans now, and you've got people that enjoy the records. So you got to do the work. It's your job.
Yeah.
But now, we enjoy doing the work.
Of course. You're an artist, so I'm not saying.
I enjoy being sane, is what I'm saying. It's not like a.
Yeah, but then you can at least manage it, and your limitations, and you know what you like to work within. So, like on this record, the last record, as you said, was sort of an animal record.
Yeah.
Because I had the songbook. Like, it's weird because I don't know you guys that well, but when, like, I was very obsessed when I couldn't find my Handsome Family songbook. I was like, that thing's a real thing. I need to, where is it? Where did I put it? Like, I have, like, because like, there's certain records where I'm like, I'll listen to it, but then I'm like, that's a precious item.
Is it like the blue book?
Yeah. I don't know where it came from. Was it in the box?
We probably sent you a bunch of things.
And I was like, this is important.
It's cool. It took forever to do that because it was before, like, Pro Tools.
Oh, really?
So I had to use this. It was a mess.
It's not. I just feel like our songs, the way we write songs and the way we want our songs to be perceived, I want them to be things that other people can sing. That they're not about us. They're just about songs that should live on, be bigger than us.
But also, they are simple to a point, but the sound is kind of, you do whatever is left from the darkness. There is a haunting quality to the music. And not in a bad way, in an atmospheric way.
How could haunting be bad?
Well, I mean, they're not Burl Ives scary. But no.
We got work to do then.
No, they are.
No, I like classic rock and classic country. Those are probably my biggest.
We like songs, I think.
Right, but there is a tone that you guys seem to get.
Sure.
And you're aware of that.
Awareness.
You do what you do, I think that's really all you...
It's probably pretty deliberate.
How are you working? You record all over at your house, and you have a studio set up? Are you an analog freak, or what do you do?
I get a lot of analog outboard gear, but it all goes in the box.
You have to, right?
I don't have... Well, you can time. I can't do tape.
Yeah.
It's too expensive. It's too hard to maintain.
Yeah.
I do appreciate the importance of warming the signal up before you go in. But in this day and age, it's like...
It's silly not to pretend computers don't exist.
Everything's going to get dithered down to digital anyway.
Because that's how everyone takes it.
Everyone's listening on earbuds from YouTube on their phone.
Everybody's going to be listening to the record on Spotify at 128K MP3 quality. So, to spend that kind of money to do it analog is kind of...
crazy.
Although I appreciate the fetishistic aspect.
Yeah, I wouldn't take that away from somebody if that's their thing.
It's cool.
Well, it's funny because Jack White will make those direct to acetate records, but there's always buzzes and fucked up things on them.
But that's part of what you're looking for.
I don't mind it, but like you do notice it, and you're sort of like, oh, that's just a live performance. I guess that buzz is going to be all the way through this record. Well, and it's kind of cool.
Ambience.
Yeah. So what's the new record? Is it a whole piece?
Yeah, it's about, well, it's mostly about colors, and is my was my basic theme. But yeah, it's stories about things that aren't easily seen, things that are just on the edge of visibility. So,
for instance,
the title says,
well,
says it all, basically.
Maybe, I don't know if you remember, have you been to the State Fair here when you were a kid? Did you remember seeing this world's smallest horse?
Yeah.
Tiny Tina?
Tiny Tina.
Well, every year I went.
It's about her.
There's a song about Tiny Tina. So it's 75 cents for a few years, a dollar. They went up to a dollar, and I still didn't go. And then one year I said, look, this is the year I'm going to go see Tiny Tina. And then she wasn't there.
Oh, no.
So I never saw Tiny Tina.
I was obsessed with human oddities. So when I was a kid, when Ronnie and Donnie were still touring, the Siamese twins.
Oh, really?
I saw Ronnie and Donnie. Wow. I saw the world's smallest man there. I saw the guy with the elephant feet. I saw, like, in human oddities, they're not easy to come by. It was sort of the end of it. This I saw the wild woman. That was that was sort of a sad moment. Because it was just a little woman who was in a box.
It's a job.
Well, that was it. That was the funny thing.
The box is the killer.
Like, no one was going to see her. They just weren't interested in her. But I went. So I had tickets, and I walked up the ramp to look in. And she was just, like, doing some organizing stuff over in the corner. And then she looked, turned around, and she saw me. And she kind of went like, all right. And she picked up a snake and went, yeah. I'm like, thanks for the show. I appreciate it. But Ronnie and Donnie, that was trippy, man, because they would just sit in their trailer. They had a fully furnished trailer, and they were living Siamese twins. Wow. And they were just sitting there watching television. And you would just go like, what? And they'd have it fairly visible where they were connected, but they wouldn't look at you or nothing. They'd just sit there and watch TV. And the world's smallest man was like about the size of a slightly large basketball, but he had that weird crippling ailment. I don't know what it was. And he would sit and talk to you. And you'd ask questions. And then the guy with the feet, you know, he had these huge deformed elephantiasis feet. And the toes were all mangled and weird.
This was the only job he was going to get then.
Right. And he was wearing like a loincloth, and he'd walk in, he goes, you can touch him. And I'm like, no.
It's $5 extra to touch him. But
I'm good.
Yeah. And then the babies in the jar exhibit, that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, I remember that at White City down by Carlsbad Caverns. Or like The Thing. There are places like
the
that
thing,
all
over. Right, cars. The roadside
These
attractions.
These things are disappearing. I mean,
I don't know
they're
what
getting
are,
cleaned up, and people are like, oh, you can't do that.
Well, they rarely took care of them, too, because you go to those roadside museums, and a lot of times they're all dusty. And
it's gross. Nonsense.
I'm often afraid that my garage is going to start looking like that if I don't keep it. Just this weird attraction that used to be relevant. Oh, well. So we got the Tina song.
So, yeah. But did you see Tiny Tina?
I didn't. I saw Tiny Tina, yeah.
Compared to the world's smallest man, I mean, would the smallest man be able to ride her?
He would have, but it would have been awkward. Because he wasn't like Tom Thumb. He wasn't a dwarf. He didn't have dwarfism. He had something else.
So he wasn't a horse rider. But
I didn't look like a horse rider, no.
I regret seeing her, but I don't regret seeing her. You know,
that's like so much in life.
Diffidence.
And what's it going to be called, the album?
It's called Unseen.
Yeah, it's like about
there's some historical stuff about William Crookes, who was one of my favorite scientists, who basically designed a vacuum tube in late 1800s in Victorian England to try to capture ghosts.
Yeah.
It was a ghost cage.
That's the origin of the vacuum tube.
Really?
So all guitar amps are really ghost trappers.
He put a filament inside a vacuum tube and was trying, and moved it around the room. And when he became excited, he was like, oh, there's a spirit. But what he was really detecting were like ions in the air or other kind of RF.
But so he wasn't really wrong.
No, he wasn't wrong.
Not really.
No.
I mean, that turned into the tube, which
that we all just bought again. We're back to ghosts
in the
glass.
The ghosts get a kickback from it, so they're making money on the other side.
Well, thank God. Thank God. I knew there had to be a conspiracy to the return to analog, is that the ghosts needed money. Well, it was great talking to you guys.
Yeah. A real treat.
That's your doubleheader WTF. All right. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF pod needs. I'll be in Chicago this Saturday, day after tomorrow, if you're listening to this on Thursday. I think there's still tickets available for the second show. I believe there is. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour to get a link to those tickets. I'm not going to play guitar today because I got to go do some painting. I'm going to help my buddy paint my bedroom. All right?
Okay.
Boomer lives!